to this meeting. I found it really interesting. And I will now continue the duo act with Neil and talk some more about path integrals. And I will not talk about the lensing stuff Neil just discussed. I will delve a little bit deeper into the application to quantum field theory and quantum geometrodynamics. So Neil already introduced these localized states. We will go even one step further and introduce what we call relativistic weak value theory, which is an extension of weak value theory developed by Aronoff and company, but then for the relativistic setting, which is new development. So, and using these techniques, which I will describe in the Schwinger effect, we hope to make a proper interpretation for geometrodynamics. That's the ultimate aim we were pursuing. So I will continue in Neil's spirit and basically assume that quantum mechanics is nothing else than interference. Because if you want to have a classical dynamics out of a quantum mechanical equation, you have to add up all the phases and you have to interfere constructively in order to get a world line out. So Neil already talked about these localized states. So in this case, psi zero is a localized state. We have assumed that to be a Gaussian, but it can be anything. It doesn't satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. Now we can propagate this initial state forward using the Hamiltonian operator, and we measure it x1. So this gives us an equation, an formula, an integral, which takes into account all the interference. So this is a path integral in this way. And this way we get this function phi, which is the amplitude to go from this initial state psi zero to x1. So if you take the initial state to have negative energy, so p zero is negative, meaning it's an antiparticle.
You speak of initial state, which depends on time?
Yes. So it's just a preparation of state.
It's not on a
Cauchy surface. But you can always extend it to the infinity in this time, this setting to infinite future, just as Neil showed, and I will show it again. But it's a departure from the textbook quantum mechanics.
Maybe just to emphasize that at this point of view, the quantum mechanics of the particle in its own proper time is absolutely conventional. So you take some state, it's a function of x and t, space and time, and you propagate it with e to the minus I s. And then the only subtlety is that we do not observe s. That's external people. So we just do completely ordinary quantum mechanics. But before we actually interpret the answer, we must integrate over s. That's it.
So if you take this amplitude and you square the amplitude, then you get this contour plot. And what you should note is that the classical trajectory for the particle, so if you just would solve the classical equation of motion, is the black line. So you see that this amplitude nicely follows the classical evolution. You see some quantum spreading, but nothing is really happening. And this is exactly what Neil was discussing in his part of the talk. But we are into the Schwinger effect, so let's dial on the electric field. I will assume for the moment a constant electric field everywhere in space, so the simplest setup, so that you can still do the equations fairly easily. And you can calculate the propagator, so that's the G. You can still convolve that propagator with the same initial state, which I will assume to be the mean value will be on shell. And what you find is that, of course, the classical trajectory becomes bended. And the amplitude squared nicely follows the classical trajectory. So it's kind of a quantum world line, so to say. So Wheeler discussed this already in the 50s, I believe, and he said, well, it's a fuzzy world line. So now the point is that this is a mild electric field. If you dial now the electric field a little bit farther up and go above the region where you expect this Schwinger effect to take be into account, then you obtain, again, the classical trajectory. But you find that there is a probability for the particle to flip to the other side, become from an antiparticle a particle, and depart up to plus infinity. And this is what we consider the Schwinger effect in this one particle kind of setup. So you should take into account that this is not a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation. H phi is minus the initial state, psi zero, the preparational state. So this is a good solution to the Klein-Gordon equation away from this initial state, so to say. So if you probe this phi away from the initial seat, then you should be able to interpret this as an probability.
As finite support or something?
That depends on where you integrate over. So if you integrate over a whole spacetime, it definitely doesn't have finite support. And it diverges.
Away from initial state?
Yes, it's a relative probability. So if you measure the particle here, or you measure the particle here, you find that it's here more likely to occur. Yes.
It goes on shell. Off shell initial state is normalizable in space time.
Yes.
But the propagated state goes on shell. And as soon as it goes on shell, that means it has support in an infinite domain of space time.
And that's just like the length of a world line is infinite. So it just continues and goes on and on and on. But if you would cut it at a certain time slice, then it's normalizable.
Yeah.
If you don't like these initial setups, so the psi zero, you can always, as Neil described, I will come to that. If you now not have a constant electric field, but you say I have a Minkowski spacetime, and I turn the electric field on for a little while and turn it off again. So here the electric field is off, here I turn it on, here I turn it off again. Then you find that the particle travels like a classical particle, like this red black line, like a classical particle in the place where there's no electric field. Once the electric field is turned on, and it's a very strong electric field, you find that the particle turns around, like the black line, the classical evolution, after which it continues like a straight line, so it's just Minkowski evolution of the particle. What you find is that there is a probability to end up here. So again, this would be pair creation, in the sense that you have a particle and an antiparticle, which turned around into embedding time. So in the proper time, it always goes forward. But in the embedding time, so to say, it can turn around. If you don't like these initial states, you can always get rid of it by saying, well, what generated this state, so to say? What is the past of this state? So you can, if you evolve it backwards and integrate from minus infinity to infinity instead of from zero to infinity, representing going also in the past. And the nice thing is that if you do this for Minkowski spacetime, then the symmetries of Minkowski spacetime tell you that you take the real part of this propagator, and you get a Hadamard function. In curved spacetime, this won't be any longer true. The real part is the one we consider. So this is with the initial state. And then once you integrate from minus infinity to infinity, you get a solution to the Klein-Gordon equation, which extends from minus infinity to infinity, which is more like the S matrix description following basically this discussion Neil just gave. So it's all nice that you can get a quantum world line, a fuzzy world line, out of the propagator by starting with an initial state psi. And you can then say, well, the propagator is only an amplitude to do something. The square is the relative probability for something to happen. What's the probability to see the particle here, that given that I've seen the particle there? However, in order to probe this further, you would like to also know how it did that. And this is, of course, always a controversial thing, because from the double slit experiment, we know that if you measure to which slit the particle went, you disturb the interference pattern. However, this formalism by Aronoff, which is called weak value theory, which we have extended to relativistic particles, which can probe a little bit of information out of the quantum mechanical evolution without actually disturbing the particle. So I will try to measure the evolution of the particle without really interfering with its evolution. So what we do is we consider von Neumann pointers. So you start with your quantum relativistic propagator with a certain action, and we consider the path integral formulation. We add the so-called pointer action to that, X and P are the canonical variables for this von Neumann pointer, which is a kind of an ideal measuring device. You couple it via this Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian has mass of the pointer and momentum of the pointer squared, just as you always do. But this term is actually important. So G is the coupling of the von Neumann pointer to the measuring device. P is the momentum of the von Neumann pointer. And O is the observable you are trying to measure. So that can be the position, it can be the electric field, it can be local, it can be non-local. That doesn't really matter. But you couple it in this way to the system. And what you now can show is that in the limits of G to zero, you can squeeze a little bit of information out of this von Neumann pointer without disturbing the quantum process. And if you go into the details of this calculation, you will find that the effect of the von Neumann pointer on the system is quadratic in G, and the effect of the system on the pointer is linear in G. And if you would do this multiple times and take an average, you could obtain a little bit of information of GO without actually interfering with the system. And this sounds very esoteric, but actually this is being done in optical quantum physics at the moment. So people are actually measuring these weak values. So how does it go? You couple the von Neumann pointer to the system this way in order to measure O. You do the experiment. Afterwards, you measure the von Neumann pointer. And what you will find is that the von Neumann pointer have shifts. So x1 is the final mean position of the pointer. X0 is the initial mean position of the pointer. Will have shifted according to the real part of the weak value, which is defined according to this formula, which is just an insertion of this operator into the Parton's rule. And the imaginary part of this observable leads to a shift in the momentum.
What is delta?
Delta is the initial spread of your pointer. And subsequently, you can change delta. You can change the initial state of your measuring device. You can look for the idealized measuring device. Note that the specifics of the measuring device are not really taking important for this weak measurement. So this is something we use to develop an interpretation for the number, the complex number you get when you insert an operator in this Parton rule. And this looks very abstract at the moment, but I will go through a few examples in which it becomes more concrete. So what we now can do is we can first develop the relativistic ABL formula. ABL stands for Aronoff, Bergmann, Lobovitz formula. And what the idea is that you start with your initial state. You go to a final state, which, by the way, I will assume to be having a big relative probability. So one of the big complaints for weak value theory is always that they say, well, I start with one state, I go to another state, which is completely unrelated to the initial state. I get crazy answers, and now I say that I've measured something funky. We don't do that. We say, well, we would like to go from an initial state and the final states, which are likely, either by classical evolution or by a tunneling phenomenon, and we are trying to probe the weak values of that phenomenon. So the ABL formula starts with an initial state. You go to a final state, and you look at what the probability is to find the particle somewhere in between. So R is what we call the fractional time, and tells you where is the particle after a fraction R of its evolution. It runs from 0 to 1. At 0, it's at the initial state. At 1, it's at the final state. And you start from the psi 0, which is the initial state. You go to psi 1, which is the final state, and you measure this Dirac delta function of xm, where xm is the position in space, so that's the place where you positioned your weak von Neumann pointer. And x mu rs determines the place of its evolution where it's sensitive to it. So we find that at r is zero, the initial particle is at its initial position, as you would expect. At r is one, it's at the final position. And in the immediate time, r is zero, it's around here, which is somewhere in between, which matches the classical evolution of a particle in an electric field with the same initial conditions, so to say. So this way you can recover the classical evolution or something close to the classical evolution while doing a quantum experiment, which is, of course, very boring because here the initial and the final states are classically connected. You can just obtain them using classical analysis. To go one step deeper, you can calculate the weak trajectory. Here I will only do for precision, but in principle you could also calculate the weak momentum. So now you say, what is the expectation value for the position, the space-time position, of the particle half time of its solution or at the initial evolution? And this is the real part of it, is the blue dot. So you see that you can now get a trajectory out which matches the classical evolution. And if the initial and the final state are real, then the imaginary part of XW will be very small and you get just a classical world line out. But it becomes really interesting once you have an initial and a final state which are not matched by classical evolution, but by a tunneling process. So you can do this in ordinary quantum mechanics with an ordinary tunneling. But here we will consider the Swinger effect, which is connected to the inverted harmonic oscillator mathematically, so in quantum mechanics. And what you find is that the initial state we consider here, Gaussian, with a certain momentum. The final state is a symmetric particle here. That's an antiparticle because it goes backwards in time. This is a particle because it goes forwards in time. The classical trajectory for these particles with these boundary conditions are the black lines. So here you have a black line. Here you have a mirror image of that black line separated by the length scale of the Swinger effect. The green line is the weak trajectory. So the weak trajectory is, as I developed here, is plotted in green. So you see that you get a trajectory which goes from, follows the legs, then turns around, and comes here. Note that in the limit of h bar to zero, we can prove that this weak trajectory actually solves the classical equation of motion. I plotted here the real part, but actually it's a complex trajectory, and it will be in the limit of h bar to zero, it will coincide with the complex classical trajectory, it will be the instanton. So using von Neumann pointers, we can give an interpretation to instantons as measurements, which is not relying on the h bar to zero limit. So this weak trajectory should be really considered as a quantum mechanical analog of that. If I now dial R up, then you find that the ABL formula moves along the leg. It's always close to the green region, but it's not really the probability distribution leading to x. And you find that once it starts to tunnel, it becomes oscillatory. It goes into the complex plane, so to say. So you find interference phenomenon happening. So R is 0.5, it's there, it turns around and goes up. Now that you only find this bouncing one because we assume the initial state to be left and the final state to be R, right? So this is really analysis saying, given that we assume that the particle goes from A to B with a certain relative probability as we described above, what is the way in which it does it? How would you measure this with a von Neumann pointer? I said that this green trajectory is a complex trajectory, and you can say, be a little bit more precise about this. So we find that the green trajectory, the weak trajectory, if you consider it in full space-time and also the weak momentum, will satisfy the constraint or be very close to the constraint. So here you find the constraint for a relativistic particle in an electric field where this is the kinetic momentum. And the constraint says that this quantity is zero. So if you solve this using classical analysis, so real x, px, and real pt, then you get two hyperboloids, which are these two red lines. So this one is one, and that one is the other one. And these are disjoint in the real analysis, saying that a classical particle will never spontaneously go from a particle into an antiparticle. However, if you now consider these initial states, which are on the different legs of these red lines, because they are classically reachable, then we find that the weak trajectory in momentum phase space will always follow closely towards the constraint sheet in the complex space. So if you now consider complex P and complex P, then this equation becomes a sheet and the two paraboloids become connected. And you can actually move from the one to the other, which is the tunneling phenomenon. And the interesting thing is that we find that this is always a geodesic. So the actual path the particle chooses to take from one point to the other point on this constraint sheet is a geodesic. So it's very close to classical analysis in a sense, even though this is complex space.
Is this specific to the 2D system?
No, we expect this to be general. So the formulas we derive are perfectly general. In order to make plots, we have to 1 plus 1.
So as far as I knew, like if you look, for example, at the 4D QCD anomaly, that's a quantum anomaly. But if you go to the analogous anomaly in two dimensions for QED, for the Schwinn effect, this is just the classical equation of motion you get. So I always thought that like 2D is special because you can interpret certain quantum effects as just already existed in the classical.
We don't expect that to be the yes. We don't expect it to be special to 1 plus 1 dimensional space. So finally, the last weak values I will introduce are the number density and the charge density. So what you should imagine is that you have your spacetime with a constant electric field. You drop a Feynman pointer at an arbitrary position in your spacetime at a measuring spacetime event. And what you say is, what is the probability shift of the Feynman pointer after it has been coupled to the system you are trying to measure? And you find that this is formulated by adding a Dirac delta function in the Feynman propagator, or the momentum in the Feynman propagator, where you divide it by E over M to get the right units. So what we find is that if you calculate this just analytically, then you find for the number density that the real part, it's difficult to say, see with the light, follows this green line. It leads to an interference phenomenon at the tunneling event, and again follows the green line. This is the real part. If you look at the imaginary part, you only find the interference phenomenon around the place where it's actually tunneling. It becomes more interesting once you look at the electric charge. There you find that the particle starts as an antiparticle, being the blue. Its locally charge is conserved, which you can show exactly. It leads to an interference pattern like here. The particle becomes from an antiparticle a particle and shoots off along the green leg. This is very similar to what Braut et al. In 1995 found using only quantum field theory methods, also interested in weak value theory. The imaginary part has very low support along the legs. So again, you find that the imaginary part becomes important whenever you're actually in the tunneling event. If you now have the weak charge density, you can also calculate the electric field, which is kind of the back reaction field of your pair creation event. And you find that the white here is the electric field you started with. And due to the creation of this particle and antiparticle, you have a dip in the electric field. So the particle creation event steals some energy from the electric field, so to say. Note that this is exactly done in 1 plus 1 dimension, in which electromagnetism is topological and very easy to evaluate. But in principle, you could do this also in higher dimensional cases. So just to conclude the Schwinger effect part of this talk, in Minkowski's space, we believe that this formalism matches towards S-matrix theory. So this is a one-particle description, but if you would consider multiple particles, then you would get something like here, what Neil described over here. So one there is, in Minkowski's spacetime, we expect to be exactly agreeing with quantum field theory. You could ask questions about unitarity. And it's interesting to say that Feynman was very worried about this. And in his memorial letter of Dirac, he described how this one particle picture actually allows you to get the vacuum decay rate, which you are used to in quantum field theory. So also that non-perturbative effect is exactly reproduced. So Feynman described this in colloquial terms. Nikos Shov actually proved this algebraically. So he actually worked it through following Dirac's Feynman's ID and found that you get exactly the same conclusions you were expecting. However, it becomes more interesting when you are in space-time which doesn't have enough symmetries. So when you're working in arbitrary curved spacetime, which not necessarily has asymptotic regions where you can actually do the S-matrix calculation, we expect this to give unique answers, whereas you can question how to do quantum field theory in curved spacetime. So we expect this to be an valid prescription for these phenomena, because it's all completely local. We don't really talk about asymptotic regions. We have a lot more control over it, since we work with these initial and the final states, which are nothing physical. It's something we use as a little bit of extra elbow room, so to say, to do our calculations. And in particular, to do weak value theory, because you cannot do that without these initial and final states. Just as I said, weak value theory enables us to actually make these calculations about how did the evolution improve the quantum system without destroying it in the process. So this is very nice for the Zwinger effect, I think. But I got originally interested about this 4 years ago while trying to study quantum gravity. So the rest of the talk, I will briefly sketch how I expect this to translate to quantum gravity, and my hope how we expect quantum gravity to become predictive following the original ideas Wheeler had in the 60s. So just a short summary into quantum geometrodynamics. These slides these plots are completely taken from Wheeler's summer school lectures many, many years ago. So what he does is he says, well, in the 60s he started to think about this. And what he says is, well, if you do ordinary quantum mechanics, interference is key. So if you have a potential which looks a little bit like this, and you have a classical particle which is above the barrier, so no tunneling, nothing fancy, they expect the particle to slow down a little bit during this time, and subsequently you expect it to speed up again. If you solve the time-independent Schrödinger equation, you never get this evolution out. But if you now take superpositions of these states and take a wave packet, then you see that due to the interference, the waves line up in such a particular way to get a peak which follows this line, the gray line. And that's kind of the maximal probability for the particle to be observed. So you find that classical behavior, classical world lines, emerge out of the quantum mechanical theory due to interference. And that's what he takes as the key insight in his formulation of quantum geometrodynamics. So this world line is here just a trajectory, but in quantum gravity, that should be the space-time. So whenever you have a fuzzy world line, like there is a finite extent to this line, you expect a fuzzy space-time, so to say. Whenever the particle becomes classical, this becomes a kind of a Dirac delta function moving around. You expect classical space-time to emerge. So in order to make this comparison and make this leap, he says, well, your space manifold in quantum mechanics becomes superspace, which is the space of all three geometries. Note that three geometries are important here, not four geometry. Four geometry space-times are emergent in Wheeler's ID. The space-time position in quantum field theory becomes a three geometry. So that's just a Riemannian three-dimensional geometry representing space. The wave function, which is normally a function of your space-time, becomes a function on three geometries. Note that, well, for a trajectory, it's very easy to order the points and say, well, the line follows this and this curve. In quantum geometrodynamics, you have to do a little bit more fancy, because there are different slicings for one space-time. So if you take one space-time, and you would slice all three possible three-dimensional slices, and you spread them out over the floor, then it's a big mess, and it's very difficult to reassemble them. But in principle, due to the interlockings of these space-times, you can prove that you can, in principle, reconstruct this space-time. And even though this sounds very difficult to do in this perspective, we believe that these weak values are ideal tools to actually help us reconstruct these three geometries back into one space-time. And of course, you have the Schrödinger equation in quantum mechanics. You have the Klein-Gordon equation for quantum field theory, or relativistic particles, so to say. And we expect that to be kind of replaced by the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So what the hope is that you then have this wave function over three geometries, which spikes around this line. including all these tree geometries. Now you know all the likely tree geometries. You spread them over the ground, you reassemble them, and you get the most likely spacetime back. And your failure to actually reconstruct this are the quantum fluctuations of spacetime, as Wheeler envisaged. We will do this. This was originally done or proposed with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which is kind of like the Klein-Gordon equation, but that has no unique solution. You need extra boundary conditions to actually make it unique. We will consider the Feynman propagator instead, which, as Neil was arguing, is unique because it's an integral and you have, I think, a lot more control over this. So the status of this equation is that it's a famous equation, it's well known. However, its interpretation still escapes us. There are a few interpretations around, but nobody really agrees on one solid interpretation. And this interpretation is very important if we want to recover classical spacetime and Einstein equations out of this theory, if we want to solve the emergence of time, or if we want to study the boundary conditions of the Big Bang. It's really important to have a solid interpretation, because if you would have the Schrödinger equation, but you wouldn't have a way to square it to calculate probabilities, why would you try to solve it? So Wheeler and DeWitt summed up the situation quite nicely, I think, in later life. They completely divorced from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. So Wheeler says, so it's one thing to have an equation, which is very nice, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. It's another to solve it, and it's yet another to actually interpret the solutions. DeWitt was a little bit more forceful, and he says, well, that damned equation should be confined to dustbin of science. And he gives a few reasons why you should divorce from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. He says, well, it's on time foliations, it's not relativistic. Man hours have been wasted on finding a natural time parameter. It's completely married to the constraints theory of quantum systems. And we have this path integral, why don't we use that one? So that's, in summary, what he describes. This is a very nice summary of this in his the book which was published after his death by his wife. And the interesting to see that it's a thick book, and there's maybe 5 pages about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, in which he basically describes his experience with this equation. So we will instead consider the propagator. Note that if you write down the Wheeler-DeWitt equation with this Dirac delta function, which is kind of the initial seed, you still haven't solved it, because you can always add a homogeneous equation solution to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation to the propagator and get another solution. So what we will consider is to start with this initial seed, which is nothing more than a little bit of elbow room for us to ask interesting questions. If you now convolve this with the initial seed with the Feynman propagator and integrate it over the lapse, which is the analog of the Schrödinger time, tau in Neil's language, then we expect to get a classical world line back, which is then the weak value. And how do you actually measure this? Well, just as I described, if you start with an initial one psi zero, you can ask what is a likely candidate for the final state using these relative probabilities. Once you have this likely final state, which often will satisfy either the solution to the classical Einstein equations or complex solutions to this equation, you can ask, how did it manage to do this? It's nice to say I go from one tree geometry to another tree geometry. It would be even nicer if we can say, what's the most likely way it did it, and what's the most likely time it did it? So this von Neumann pointer becomes an idealized quantum clock. So we have worked this all out, and it becomes complicated because the mass of the clock will backreact on the universe, and you have to be very careful, but we worked it through, and I hope to publish this later this year, which I believe is a very natural interpretation for quantum geometry dynamics, because it also matches quantum field theory, as we saw with this Schrödinger effect. So the nice thing is that I developed this already in my first year of my PhD, but then Neil said, I don't believe it. So we decided to do the Schrödinger effect to actually see how it works for quantum theory, which you actually trust. The Schrödinger effect is very robust, and everyone agrees that it exists, and hopefully in the near future we can actually measure it with lasers. So in summary, and I will be in time, as Lena will appreciate, we think that the Schrödinger effect can be done with the world line quantization, even though the world line quantization is a one particle way of formulating quantum field theory without fields. The fields really become the amplitudes and the amplitude squared become the fuzzy world line, according to Wheeler's language. Relativistic weak value theory is something we developed and hope to publish very soon with Laura, Angelica, Neil, where we will work out all the more technical details of this Schwinger effect and talk about unitarity and go through all the steps. So we will describe this and at the same time try to summarize the status of the field with respect to how do you go from this one particle state to the multi-particle state. This has been worked out, but we will just summarize it in order to give you an overview. And finally, what I find most interestingly is that I believe that this interpretation for quantum field theory, relativistic particles, nicely generalizes to quantum geometrodynamics, fulfilling the hole which Wheeler left after developing the Wheeler-DeWitt equation and the Parton tool. So I think there has been a very long history in this quantum geometric subject. Most of the current fashionable ways to do quantum gravity have something to say about the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. Either you discretize it, like loop quantum gravity, as far as I understand, or you satisfy it as in string theory. But I think it's an interesting problem to see whether we can make that predictive, even though it doesn't necessarily give us ultimately the atoms of space-time. Wheeler had ideas about that using topology, but we haven't really looked into that, and I'm not sure what the status of that is. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do you have any more questions?
Can you define inner product between wave functions on the space of the geometry? Because that, I think, would involve an integral over the space of three geometries, which is an infinite dimensional integral, it's a functional integral.
Yes.
And so can you make sense of that? I suppose you need some regularization or something.
So we believe that we can make sense of this using this Pieker-Lifshitz theory, as Neil already alluded to, and what we will try to sketch during the discussion session. So you could always complain and say, well, this is all very nice and formal, but who knows what the spot integral is? It's a highly dimensional oscillatory integral, and how do we do this integral? And what we believe that you should do is you should start from that oscillatory integral, flow it down the contour, or flow it down into complex plane. You take the action, you take the real part of the action, or either action. You flow this into the complex plane, infinite dimensional complex plane. So we have actually worked through examples where we can actually do this. So Neil will, I think, do the harmonic oscillator, but we expect this to extend far more generally. And then you get a Lorentzian formulation of the Feynman-Katz formula, where you relate this integral to Wiener measures, which are actually mathematically perfectly well defined.
So in the beginning you mentioned this with the point particles. So maybe it's better also to go back to the slide. So is it also working for Dirac particles? Because I think it's even before that. So it's in the beginning somewhere where you this one. So you have a scalar product, the internal scalar product, essentially it's over the space-time.
Yes.
And for fermions, this is not positive definite normally, so it's...
So we've been looking into this also with Angelica and Laura, and it's very interesting to see the history of this question, because the Dirac equation naively might not work.
The continuity equation and et cetera.
Yes, but if you look into the literature, you will find a paper by Feynman and Gell-Mann, one of the few papers where they actually work together. You can already see the split in their personality. The first part is by Feynman, the other part is by Gell-Mann. But there they have a different description of the Dirac field, which is actually second order in time derivatives, so to say. And we believe that we can make sense of this whole picture using that formulation of the Dirac equations. But the cat is the bag. When it's in the bag, you only can make claims once you actually have proven it. So we think we got very close, and okay, we want to come back to that once this is published.
Do you have any reference, preliminary, like an open archive or something?
Not yet this, but you can always look at Feynman and Gell-Mann. It's a beautiful paper.
Any more questions? Not, let's thank you again.